Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got author and police sergeant, Patrick J. O'Donnell. Now, as you may know from several previous episodes, and if you know me real well in real life, you know that I was a kind of a punk rock skateboard kid in the late 80s, early 90s. And a lot of that has continued on to this day. So you would think that I would have a natural cats and dogs relationship with the police. When in fact, I don't. See, I was raised on cop dramas on television. And I know that sounds ridiculous that should have shaped my perception of things, but it did. So when I saw a lot of the things that I saw, I didn't automatically think all cops are dicks. I thought these cops are dicks. When I would run across one that was, you know, being racist or, you know, treating us like garbage because we looked funny, you know, things like that. You're going to find that in all walks of life. I didn't automatically assume because they were doing the job, they were bad people. And I knew a lot of people that did. It was just an opinion I just couldn't share, especially when I actually had a moment where a cop busted us in a church parking lot. We had set up a quarter pipe and we were skateboarding. And we thought for sure he was going to kick us out, but he pulled a board out of his trunk and a pair of shoes, and he skated with us for like a half hour, you know, and then he told us to don't do drugs and, you know, went on his merry way. And it was really kind of an amazing experience. You know, but what are you going to do? People are people. I've had a great deal of respect for people who decide that they want to put themselves in service of something greater than themselves. I also have a real respect for authors. And so I had a great conversation with Patrick. Now, before we get started, I do have to tell you something right out of the gate. Patrick O'Donnell does not officially represent any specific police or law enforcement agency, and does not intend for any of this conversation to be legal advice. If you need a lawyer, get one. Now that that's out of the way, I have a great conversation with this guy. We go through all kinds of stuff. In fact, he sort of tears down one of my favorite police dramas. And again, you might even think that that would be something that would make me sad, but it actually didn't at all. I really, really love learning things like that. And so I found it to be an exclamation of joy. I had a lot of fun with it, and I think you're going to have a lot of fun with it too. So I'm going to shut up, and I'm going to let Patrick J. O'Donnell tell you all about it.
But the cool thing about my life right now is I'm about 5.5 months from being eligible to retire. So nice. I almost have my 25 in.
Excellent. I mean, that's a long time to put in the service.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of shit. I mean,
I bet.
Oh yeah, I should ask you, is this a clean podcast? Is
no, it's not. Loud? No. Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I've done like 8 or 9 podcasts with the release of the latest books, so some are clean, some aren't, and I don't want to I don't want to go down that road. But yeah, so about 6 years ago, five, 6 years ago, I wrote a book, and that was on how to buy a car. Before I was a cop, you know, I went to college, and my degree's in sociology, my minor is criminal justice, and, you know, you get out of college, and if you're not going to teach, then you don't have a lot of options. So, yeah, I worked in fast food, I sold cars, I bartended. Make long story short, I helped a lot of people buy cars afterwards, and I continued to do that. And, you know, especially when the internet was not flourishing, when it was, when it wasn't even there, or when it was new.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of it was guesswork and the old, you know, barter system and, you know, negotiation, et cetera, et cetera. So I helped a lot of people buy cars. So I'm like, okay, that's cool. What I could do is write a book about that and start a side business. So I did. And I wrote it under a pen name, really shitty cover, not the best editing job in the world, but I threw it up on KDP, and, you know, it still sells like a couple a month, you know, and I do zero advertising, zero marketing, zero everything. I'm like, all right, well, whatever. But it got me into the world of publishing, self-publishing.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, cool. So then, as most cops do, I went through a horrible divorce about 5 years ago, and I wrote a book about that, and most of that was just self-therapy than anything else.
Sure,
yeah. It felt good just to get the words on the page and just kind of, you know, it just feels good. So I did that, and then before I published it, you know, I gave it a really good hard look, and I'm like, yeah, this is full of venom. That's no good for anybody. So I cut it like in half, and I cut most of the venomous stuff out of there. And I tried to make it as positive as possible. It's called Divorced Dad, Kids Are Forever, Wives Are Not. And, you know, I geared it towards men going through divorces. But what I found out, and I didn't do my due diligence for marketing, was most guys don't buy books about divorce. Women do.
Yeah.
The biggest chunk of my readership was females. It was like 75%. You know, and they were totally cool about it, even with the, you know, with the title. You know, they weren't offended or anything like that. So it was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek, and most of them got it. Some did not.
Yeah.
And
welcome to the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I'm a very conversational person, and that's how I write.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wrote a there was a gal that was, well, she's a doctor. I shouldn't call her a gal, I guess. But there was a doctor that has like one of the biggest divorce forums on the internet. And she reached out to me and she's like, hey, you know, I liked your book. If you want to write, you know, like a guest blog or an article, I'm like, okay, cool. And it wound up being like the second or third highest rating, like views or whatever for the year, for last year. But she wrote me back and she said, yeah, you know, in your book, you say, you know, you were dating this girl. Girl connotates, you know, under 18. And I'm like, it does? And I'm like, okay, I understand that, but I'm not a creeper, dude. You know?
Yeah.
Whatever. So that was that. So I wrote a post-apocalyptic book. I thought, hey, that'd be kind of fun. I like reading it, so I'll write it. And that was okay. I was writing the sequel to that book. And I just went out on, do you know what 20 books to 50K is?
No. What is that?
That is a huge self-publishing Facebook group. And now it's, you know, he's got Craig Martell and Mike Landerly are the ringleaders of that. And they've got 34,000 members.
Wow.
It's a huge following. And they're having their third conference in Vegas this year. I'm going to be a speaker for helping out authors with, like, law enforcement questions.
Yeah.
Policey stuff.
Right,
but, the cool thing about it, it's all indies, it's all independent authors, and, you know, it's just a community of trying to help each other out, trying to figure stuff out as we go along. But I was on the Facebook group, and I just did a selfie with just me, this big, furry police hat, and a cigar, and like, hey, you know what, anybody got questions about police stuff? I've seen and done just about everything. And the response was incredible. I had a ton of people asking me questions. And I'm like, So a couple of people are like, hey, you should really write a book about that. And I'm like, okay, well. So I did. It's called Cops and Writers, From the Academy to the Street. And that is mostly the basics as far as how does somebody become a cop, you know, what goes on during the academy now, what went on 25 years ago when I went through it.
Yeah.
You know, the different units within the, you know, like within patrol, such as like SWAT, K-9, the helicopters, you know, all that kind of cool stuff. So I did that, and I also started a side business. I'm consulting with screenwriters and authors and how to get their police procedure more realistic.
Yeah.
I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, because there's a lot of need for the authenticity in things to make it better.
Yeah.
Like I'm a big fan of the Harry Bosch series, you know.
I
love that stuff, but it definitely seems like somebody did the research on this.
Yeah, but you know, everybody's telling me how great Harry Bosch is, so I thought, because I can't watch most TV shows that right. are like police ones. It just drives me out of my mind. We all laugh about it at work. We're like, oh my God, did you see that shit last night? And it's like, yeah, it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
But Bosch, you know, he's in the first episode, he's in the middle of some kind of, like, he had a shooting, and the other guy had a gun, but I guess it was kind of fuzzy or whatever, and he's in some type of court proceeding, and I don't know if what that proceeding is. It wasn't very clear. Maybe I have to watch more episodes. I don't know, but I like the character himself, but yeah. Here's the things that stuck out in my head. If he's going through some kind of court proceeding, what happens is if you shoot and kill somebody on the job, there's two separate and distinct investigations, and they go in order. The first one is a criminal.
Yeah.
Which means if I shoot and kill somebody at work, that is a homicide, technically. Now, it's up to the district attorney, through their investigation, to say, was it justifiable or not? But it's still a homicide.
Yeah.
And while that investigation is going on, I'm on the sidelines. I'm right. We call it riding the pine. You're behind a desk.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still a cop. You know, you're not suspended. They just don't want you going out and getting into another critical incident while you're going through a critical incident.
Yeah.
You know, so it's more for your protection than anything else. It's for the cops' protection. But I'm looking and I'm like, okay. And he's saying, well, I've already been cleared by the department. And I'm like, well, you just did it exact opposite then. But yeah, I mean, okay, so that's, yeah, it's Hollywood. But
yeah.
If he's going through this criminal, and then over the weekend, he sweet-talks some detectives by giving them, you know, Lakers tickets or some shit like that. And it's like, oh, hey, you know what? You know, let's do this. And, you know, you guys go to the Lakers game, and I'll just go solve these murders, you know? And I'm just like, bullshit. Are you fucking kidding me? That guy's lieutenant and or captain would have his ass. He would be fired. He would be gone. And I'm just like, okay. Then he goes up to the apparent suicide scene with the girl with her head on the steering wheel, and you know the gun is still like in her lap, and he like picks up her head and is like looking at her and sniffing her, and I'm like, what the fuck is this guy doing? Nobody does that shit. And then he picks up the gun and he's sniffing the barrel, and I'm like, are you fucking half retarded? What is wrong with you, dude? You know, it's like, no, this is completely, completely wrong. No, no, we don't do that. That's all Hollywood shit. And I'm just like, oh my God. I watch it and I'm like, another disappointment. This sucks. And then he goes back to his apartment, like overlooking the city and stuff.
Right.
Cops don't make that much money. I'm thinking to myself, man, he's living in the Hollywood Hills looking at like, what is that, his house? Well, or what
they,
is that?
The irony is they reveal that the reason he was able to buy that house is because he consulted on some Hollywood movie.
Ah, okay.
And got paid to do that. So but
yeah, I'm watching this, you know, and I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, no, that was my first thought too, was that's, he's in LA and he's in the hills. There's no way.
Right. I could barely afford to put gas in my car in L.A., you know? It's,
yeah.
It's like, holy shit, or go out to eat.
Yeah.
That's not on a cop salary, that's for sure.
Oh, definitely not. So, I mean, it's a really intense thing, though. The fact that people decide that they're going to get into this, that I think it's a thing that people don't really think about, is the fact that you're not going to get rich.
No.
So you've got to have something inside you that says that you want to be of service. You know, it's like joining the military. It's like being a teacher. There's something in it that makes you decide that you want to be a part of a system that helps people. So what drew you to it?
You know, I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth, but I love it. I love public service. You know, like you were saying, like teachers, my oldest son is in the Army. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of runs in the family a little bit. My father or grandpa, none of them were police officers. Both my parents are Irish immigrants. So, I mean, they were dirt poor.
Yeah, but they weren't cops.
No, I know. Well, I'm Irish. You know, it's like either you're a firefighter, a cop, or some kind of politician. And yeah. I hate politics, and I don't like heights. So by default, I'm a cop. But I grew up in Chicago as a kid, and our neighbors, the cops were doing a search warrant, which means, you know, the SWAT team was there. They're doing a dynamic entry where they're blowing, you know, they got the big ram and they're ramming the door down and stuff. And the houses are very close to each other. So I'm looking, I'm like maybe 11 or 12 years old. I'm looking out the window. There's two cops in our backyard with M16s and shotguns. And then the other guys, I'm watching them breach the door, like maybe 30 feet away. It was like watching TV, but it was live. Yeah, and they're pulling people out, and they're kicking and fighting and spitting, and I'm just like, that's got to be the coolest job in the world, man. That's awesome.
Yeah.
that looks cool. So when I went to college, I did an internship with the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Department, and I just loved it. I'm just like, oh, hell yeah. This is the job for me. This is kick-ass. But something inside just kind of clicked, and I think it's just the satisfaction. You actually are helping people. People call you when they're having the worst day of their life. They don't call you when things are super awesome. They don't dial 911 and say, hey, everything's really cool. You want to come over for, you know, barbecue? And
like, right.
Nothing like that. Somebody's in crisis. Somebody's, you know, something bad happened or is about to happen.
Yeah. I would have to imagine that's got to be tough to keep your head on straight when that's what your job is to see that. So,
you know,
I mean, how do you manage those things?
A big part of it is a sense of humor. You got to have a sense of humor about it. And it's a really dark sense of humor that, man, most people outside of the little cop world would think, man, what the F is wrong with this guy, man? he needs some help really bad, you know, but it's how you deal with it. And I guess a big part is you have to keep on telling yourself, and you have to remind yourself, not everybody hates you, especially when I worked at night. I worked nights for 17 years, and I worked in the worst neighborhoods of the city. And, you know, it was nothing to go through 1, 2, 3 shootings a night.
Yeah.
You know, that would be my scene or be a part of it or whatever. And you're dealing with a lot of drunks. You're dealing with a lot of antisocial behavior, et cetera, et cetera. Then I went day shift, and it's like, oh, and even at night, you'd have people come up to you, hey, thanks a lot for what you do, blah, blah, blah. You know, and even our chief is just like, oh, we have to mend the fractures between the police department and the community. And, you know, that's a big part of like a national agenda or narrative that you see online or on TV. And it's like, yeah, there are some problems, but for the most part, there really isn't. I worked in an all-black neighborhood, and I'm about as white as white could be. And I didn't have those problems. You know, if you talk to people like they're human beings, and, you know, there are instances where, you know, you have to use heavy control talk. You have to, you know, like, drop the fucking gun, drop the fucking knife. You know,
right.
It's like, you, over there, stand there. You know, I have to be in control of the situation. But, yeah, I've had people invite me into their houses. Hey, you know what? I was a Korean War vet or a Vietnam vet. These are my medals. You know, we sat down and talked about it, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom like everybody wants to portray it as.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
Well, that's the rough thing about just about every situation is that I think that with a lot of the online conversations, the nuances and everything are lost. So it's strictly a black and white all the time. It's right. Either it's all bad or it's all good. And people just start picking their teams. And it's really not about that. If we're going to survive as humanity, we've got to be able to start recognizing each other on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Even except for the, like, say, extreme right or the extreme left, mm-hmm. most people want the same shit.
Yeah.
Most people have the same, you know, strategy. They have the same. They want the same end game. You know, yeah. They want to be happy, healthy, you know, and live out a decent life. That's all you want. You know, that's what people want. But it doesn't sell advertising dollars on the 10 o'clock news. Like, you know, cops helped, you know, 10-year-old kid across the street, you know, or helped him buy some books for school or a pencil or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's like, no, we have to pick the most dynamic, shitty-looking whatever, fill in the blank, and it's like,
right.
Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, all right, but I get it. I mean, that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
And that's what it boils down to.
Well, I mean, and there are definitely issues to be addressed. When something goes wrong, it should be called out. And I think we can all agree on that. But there's also the other side of this story where it's like, you know, this is a situation with an individual who did what they did. And on the other side of that, there are all of these other bits and pieces, but to paint the entire system with a broad brush, I think is probably a mistake. There's room for improvements in places here and there, but ultimately it still comes down to a human issue, and human beings are people, they're not systems.
Right, you're absolutely right, but I just hate the sensationalizing that goes on, you know, like the hands up movement. I don't know how many years ago that was, but it was proved that that shooting didn't happen like that at all. And all these celebrities, sports people, you know, blah, blah, nobody turned around and said, hey, I'm sorry, I caused, you know, everybody just follows blindly. It's like, oh yeah, of course, that white racist cop shot that poor black person because he was black. Yeah, you know, and it's like, nobody looks at the facts of the individual's case, you know, da, da, da. It drives me absolutely crazy, but that's not going to sell any advertising dollars. That's not going to make anybody any money. You know, people want the sensational. People want, you know, they want that big fire. They want, you know, and it's like, and that's unfortunate. You know, it's, and the truth gets whitewashed like way underneath the weeds, and people see it as fact then. And it's like, oh, that's unfortunate.
So tell me a little bit about when you discovered, writing, because you had said that you just decided that you were going to write this book, but there's a path to that. Did you ever write as a kid?
Well, when I was a little kid, my mom was a clerk typist. That's what she did in an office. That's back before computers,
yeah.
More or less. And she would have to take typing tests where see how many words per minute she could type. And I thought it was cool, and I would time her, and then I'd start plinking around with it, and all of a sudden, I kind of taught myself how to type. Then I took typing when I was in high school, mostly because there was cute girls in there, but the ulterior motive, of course. But I also knew I was going to be going to college, and I didn't want to pay people to write my term papers.
Yeah.
So back then, you know, you had to turn in term papers, and you typed them on a typewriter. And if you didn't know how to type, you'd have to pay somebody to do it. I didn't have a lot of money, so I learned how to do that.
So typing was something that you figured out how to do.
Yeah, pretty much. And as far as like writing a book, most cops are very good storytellers, and they're, you know, a typical night is like, say you are in a car chase, you're in a pursuit.
Yeah,
they last on average 5-10 minutes is a really long one. Of course, there's like dynamic ones that last like an hour or something like that. Those are rare.
Right.
Most are done within a couple of minutes. Either the bad guy's car crashes, the supervisor, which is what I am, will call it off because it doesn't fit the criteria of that department's pursuit policy, or it's just not safe anymore. I mean, they're inherently dangerous. and you have to weigh the risk benefit.
Yeah.
Now, if this guy just killed somebody and is, yeah, okay, we should probably, there's a definite risk to the general public. Yeah, we need to get this guy. But say he was a shoplifter.
Yeah.
That stole, you know, like $5 worth of whatever. Yeah, we'll get him next time. That's fine. You know, but you have that pursuit. Say you arrest somebody, the booking process might take an hour or somewhere in that ballpark. Now you're writing reports for a good 4, 5, 6 hours.
Right.
And whatever you write, your boss has to approve. It's like going to your teacher or the principal's office. You know, you go to your lieutenant who's sitting behind a desk, and back in the day when I was a new cop, he'd red pen the shit out of your report. You know,
yeah.
And if you spelled something wrong, your grammar was bad, or you know, you didn't have it right. I had one sergeant, he was the acting lieutenant, he took out a Zippo. Now I'm working midnight to 8, and it's like 10 or 11 in the morning. I just want to go home. I'm freaking beat. And he looks at it and he starts giggling, and I'm like, "What are you giggling at, Sarge?" He takes out a Zippo and a lighter and starts my report on fire. And I'm just like in front of you, and I'm like, "Oh man, come on, Sarge." He's like, "Hey, I guess you're gonna be here a while." And I'm just like, "Son of a biscuit, this sucks. I'm just a mess with this." But you're gonna, different entities are gonna be reading your reports.
Yeah.
And then if it's a more serious crime, detectives, detective lieutenants, sergeants are going to be reading those reports. And then if it goes to trial, defense attorneys are going to be reading your report.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whenever you write a police report, one goes to the DA and one goes to the defense side. That's discovery. You know, a lot of police dramas or whatever, courtroom dramas, it's like the guy at the last second comes in, "Look what I've got." Yeah. It's like, no, nope. Doesn't work that way. We all know who's going to be getting called up there. We know what the evidence is, what the police reports are. Both sides read both of them.
Yeah.
They know exactly what's what. So after a while, you become good at writing reports. Now, after a while, it gets a little boring, depending on the situation, because you're going to a lot of the same kind of calls. So as far as the writing goes, like I told you before, you know, hey, I wrote a book about how to buy a car. Then I wrote a book about divorce, and I did a post-apocalyptic fiction. Then I kind of just segued into the cops and writers thing, and I was already helping writers, you know, with their books, doing technical advice for them.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of a natural segue.
Yeah. I find all that really interesting. You know, the fact that one, you're working a job that's going to give you a lot of different stories to tell, because you're interacting with a lot of different kinds of people. You know, one of the things that I've often said is that if you don't go out into the world, you're not going to have anything to talk about. It's important to get out there and see things and meet people.
Right. I have a lot of friends that are writers now because of all of this exposure. And some of them I feel bad for. And it's like, you know, they've got excellent imaginations and they can write some really good stories. But like you said, if you don't have the life experience, it really kind of shines through, I think.
Yeah.
People can see through that. You know, you can do your due diligence. You can do your research, which, you know, I did a ton of research for this book.
Yeah.
I've been through just about anything you can think of and then some. But I just wanted to see how other departments across the country did what they do. So, I mean, I interviewed people, different people from law enforcement from across the country. I interviewed forensic investigators. I interviewed people from medical examiners' offices. You know, even people a little bit outside of, like, the police world, but have something to do with us.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Oh, yeah. It was, but it was worth it. But, you know, writing about something that I'm considered an expert, when I testify in court, I'm considered an expert in police procedure. So it comes natural, and I'm not going to say it's easy, but, you know,
yeah.
I wouldn't do very well writing a book about geology.
Right.
I don't know. You know, I'd be like, huh? So, yeah.
So that. Tell me a little bit about... you know, some of the, some of the instances where you've been called in to try to talk to people who are having a suicidal episode?
I've had a lot of those. And most of the time, if we're getting called to, somebody will dial 911 and say their friend is trying to kill themselves, or maybe even the person is going to say it. Most of the time, that person probably isn't 100% serious. You know, they're having ideas about it.
Yeah.
But most of the time, as a police officer responding to a scene, the deed has already been done.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And those are usually the people that don't really talk about it. Those are the people that, you know, their friends and neighbors are like, holy shit.
Yeah.
We didn't really think that was going on. Or he may or she may have said something off the cuff, but they weren't like walking around for months wearing black, you know, right, like boo-hooing about the world is coming to an end tomorrow, I better just off myself, you know, nothing like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I remember, and a lot of times it's just heart-wrenching. I remember I went to a suicide where a gentleman, he was probably in his early 30s, he was a school teacher, and his wife had passed away a year ago. And she had two heart transplants. They just didn't take.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she passed away. And I walk in the house, and he didn't show up for school that morning. And he didn't talk about suicide at all.
Right.
You know, I talked to his fellow teachers, and they're the ones who found him. Because he left his front door open, and he didn't come into work, and they're like, well, that he's always at work, and if he's not going to be at work, he's going to call us. He's not answering his phone. We felt like something was wrong. So they go in there, and they found him, and I walked in, and you know, they ran out of there. They're just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And the house was filled with pictures of him and his wife. And I go in his bedroom, and the closet is still filled with her clothes. She's been dead for a year.
Yeah.
And he still had her phone on the charger, like on the bedstand.
Yeah.
And all of her toiletries were in the bathroom. He didn't disturb anything for over a year. The, you know, like the kitchen refrigerator was packed with wedding pictures and other pictures of them, like having fun, da da da. And then I go in the basement and he hung himself with a book bag. He was just on his knees and he just like leaned forward. And I was just like, holy shit. I felt horrible. I'm
yeah.
just like, this poor guy, this sucks. But, you know, then you have also the suicides where somebody's talking about it. I mean, I've literally done the bridge thing. I've done a couple with knives. We had a man, I don't know, he really wouldn't do a dialogue with us. You always try to talk to the person.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to take a while. Usually it takes a long time. But if they're willing to talk to you, 9 out of 10 times, they're not going to try to kill themselves right then and there.
Right.
You know, they want to talk, but, you know, it's awkward at first. And you try to develop a rapport. And then hopefully you can develop that rapport and then come to a peaceful ending to the whole thing.
Right.
To the situation. But this gentleman, I remember, there was me and three other cops, and he was out in front of his house. And he had a big old butcher knife to his chest, and we're like, dude, you know, let's talk about this, you know, blah, blah. And he just smiled at us with the weirdest, I could close my eyes and still see it today, and he just plunged it right into his chest. And he just ran. He started running. We're like, holy shit. And, like, I'm running after a guy who just stabbed himself in the chest. And he just dropped after maybe a half a block or something like that. He did not die. Then a year later, to the day, guess what? The same guy with a butcher knife. So there must have been something about that day. There had to have been like some kind of anniversary or something really that was the trigger.
Yeah.
And there was me and a couple of other cops and a sergeant there, and we're all looking at each other, and I'm just like, man, he looks familiar, Sarge. And he didn't talk a whole lot, which is bad.
Yeah.
If they don't talk at all, that really sucks. And another cop is like, hey, that's the guy from blah, blah, blah address. And I'm like, holy shit, it is. So I go up to him like, dude, I said, here's the thing. You remember how bad that hurt last time?
that knife just plunging in your chest, and he's just like, I sure do. And he dropped it, and that was the end of it. And I'm just like, oh, okay, that's good. Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah, it's bad to do that, but then when you remind somebody of the pain and all the bullshit that they have to go through afterwards, it's like, man, you need some help, man. Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, and then I've talked people off of bridges. We had, I remember one night we had an assignment to back up the sheriff's deputies that were, there was a bridge that was an older bridge, so they tore it down, and it was over a freeway, a busy freeway.
Yeah.
And they didn't secure it like they should have. So here's this guy, he's probably about 6'3", 6'4". He weighed at least 300 pounds. It was raining outside. He had no shirt on, and he was wearing skinny jeans. And we're like, oh, come on. There's nothing to grab onto. Yeah. So these two sheriff's deputies are talking to him, and his back is to the highway. He's literally one step away from falling off this bridge. So we're all kind of like, me and another sergeant buddy of mine started walking up because we wanted to help out these sheriff's deputies. And the way we are trained is you don't grab people when they're by bridges. Because many times you're going to go down with them. And that's no good for anybody.
Right.
So they had a dialogue with this guy. Now it starts pouring rain, and I'm just like, can anything else happen? And they're like, holy shit. And they weren't getting very far. It wasn't going good. And one of the deputies lunged out and grabbed this guy. And we're like, fuck, holy shit.
Yeah.
That's not cool. Yeah. So now we're playing tug of war with this dude. And like I said, he was like 6'4", 300 pounds. And he's wearing skinny jeans. And I'm like, there's nowhere to grab onto this guy.
Yeah.
And these deputies, you know, they're starting to get pulled to the end. So we're grabbing onto the deputies. And I just grabbed down to his ankles. The guy that wanted to jump onto his ankles. I'm literally like looking over, and I'm just looking at the cars buzzing by, and I hate heights.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh shit, man, I hope this ends good, man. You know, so yeah, we got him off. So that ended. That was a positive outcome.
Yeah.
That was a positive outcome.
But is there a training that goes on to try to, talk with these people beforehand, like the some sort of psychological understanding or something?
The last couple of years, our department, and I think this is more nationwide, there's a lot of training to become more aware of mentally ill people and what to do in certain situations. When I went through the academy, it was zip.
Yeah.
How good of a talker are you? You know, that's what it all boils down to. We have negotiators, but okay, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. There ain't no negotiators working.
Yeah,
it's you got to call them up. Yeah, you're that guy or that gal.
Yeah.
And now I'm a sergeant, so I rely, most of the time the cop will get there before I do. I'm a street sergeant. And if I think the cop is doing a good job, I just let him run with it. But if they're floundering or it's just not a good fit, because, you know, it's like anything else in life.
Sure.
Some people just mesh. And some people don't. And sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to it. It just happens that way.
Yeah.
So, So, as far as that goes, we do have training. I just went through 40 hours. It was called critical incident training.
Yeah.
And we actually did scenarios. The department is serious about it. They hire professional actors and actresses. So you're not doing these scenarios with people you work with every day.
Right, yeah.
You know, and it's funny, I had the bridge one with the girl, you know, hanging over a bridge. And, you know, she's telling me to go fuck off and this and that. And, you know, and I'm just like, oh, okay, you know. So we got our reps, and I did my research. I read a couple of books when I was a rookie or even before I was in the academy. I always found that this was an interesting topic.
Yeah.
And a couple of like big no-nos that use common tropes like on TV that you see. One, you know, you have a guy that wants to kill himself. Oh, get his wife over here so she can talk to him. Hell no. She might be the reason why he wants to kill himself. That's not a good idea. You don't bring any civilians into the scene because a lot of times it's not going to help, and B, it's a very dangerous situation.
Right.
A lot of times people want to kill themselves, you know, by suicide by cop.
Yeah.
or they just start spraying or whatever. It's not an environment you want a civilian in at all.
Yeah.
And another thing, a common trope that you see in movies and books is, you know, the priest or the pastor or the minister, you know, trying to help out.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to talk this guy down from whatever incident. Well, unfortunately, what happens is a lot of people who are about to kill themselves, they do acknowledge the fact there are some religions that consider that a mortal sin.
Yeah.
And they're looking for absolution. So I'm reading this book. It was a Chicago negotiator, a negotiator for the Chicago Police Department. And he talked about how, against his advice, somebody that outranked him brought in this priest. And this poor guy who was had a gun, he says he's going to kill himself. He says, "Father, I know it's a mortal sin. You know, I know I'm going to go to hell." And the priest was like, "No, my son, you will not go to hell if you kill yourself." He's like, "Oh, okay." Boom, kills himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's looking for some absolution. He's looking for somebody to say, "Hey, it's okay."
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't want that there either.
But that's, it sounds like that's a, that can be a real tricky situation, because I know that, you know, getting people to have an understanding of mentally ill people is a difficult thing to do in the first place. And now you're going into the fray, you know, the cops are going into the fray, having to have conversations with people, now having to have training in how to interact with people. It's not something that I expect is a one-size-fits-all situation. So it seems like while things are definitely improving, it seems like it's something that's incredibly difficult. How do people deal with that?
I think it's all situational. Some people are better than others. Some cops are naturals at this, and they gravitate towards it.
Yeah.
When they hear like a call like this come over the radio, sometimes you have the same people that'll go to that call, or at least they'll try to, because they're good at it. And
yeah,
like I said, they gravitate. You know, there's some cops that are really good with drug arrests, and some that don't want anything to do with it. There's some cops that are great at drunk driving arrests. They can, you know, pound one of those out in an hour, and there's others that it takes them 8 hours to do the same paperwork.
Yeah.
You know, there's some cops that love to chase cars and some that don't want any part of that. You know, it holds true for that as well. If you're good at it and you have a knack, I mean, training is excellent. You know, I don't think you can have enough training. I don't think there's such thing as too much training, but life experience, you know, as a rookie cop, you know, you learn by seeing what the veterans were doing.
Right.
And if you're good, you're going to take note of what works and what doesn't work. And it's like, okay, yeah, note to self, don't do that. Yeah, or yeah, that cop really did a good job with that. You know, outstanding. That's freaking awesome.
Well, that's... So, yeah, that's... I think that it's definitely something that is becoming more and more prevalent as far as the discussion about mentally ill people and, you know, how we fit in society and, you know, how much of it is something that if we can start talking about it, we can start owning it a little better. Like,
yeah,
because I was raised with, you know, with my particular cocktail of mental illness. And after a certain point, it became something that I needed to own and figure out how to manage as an adult, or it was going to take me out one way or the other.
Right.
And I think that that's most people's experience. But the fact that we're just starting to have kind of a national conversation about it, is making people a little more aware of their own things and being able to raise their hand and say, "Yeah, I think I got something here, and I need some help managing it."
And yeah, I think I mean, I couldn't agree more with you, because, like I said, I worked nights for 17 years, and a lot of times you couldn't tell the difference between somebody who was just drunk off their ass, acting crazy, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Compared to going to a mentally ill person that was having some kind of crisis episode, or you had the person who was going through a mentally ill person going through a crisis, that was mixing their drugs with alcohol and street drugs.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden, that's a cocktail for disaster. I mean, you just, as a street cop, you're like, holy shit, what do I do with this? You know,
yeah.
That gets really, really intense really fast.
Right, because the person you're dealing with is no longer in reality.
No, not even close. Not even close. I mean, I had a gentleman who had really bad PTSD. He was living with his sister. He was a vet. He was living with his sister. He was probably in his late 40s, early 50s. And he was on a three-day drinking binge. He hadn't slept. And his sister's like, I know he's taking some other drugs. And he's mixing it with his psych drugs. And he's super dangerous right now. I want him out of the house. And I'm like, okay, great. So we go down there. He was super confrontational. And he came at, did he have a knife? No, he didn't have a knife. But he came at us, you know, like attacking.
Yeah.
And the officer that I was with, I took point. I was in the front. The officer that was behind me had a taser. He tased him like four times. It had zero effect on him. So we had to take him down to the ground, and I don't want to hurt this guy. You know, he's not a criminal. He's going through this horrible situation, but at the same time, I have to protect his sister upstairs, and I got to protect myself and my cops, too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a trick bag, you know, and no amount of training really trains you for that.
Right.
You know, and like I said, inherently, it's in the back of your head. This poor guy has gone through a lot of bullshit in his life. And I don't want to hurt him, but he's got almost like superhuman strength right now. I'm a pretty big dude, and the other cops I'm with are pretty big, and he was, as I was going down, my face hit the metal bar that was on a futon.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got this big shiner, and he started scratching at my face. He thought bats were attacking him, I found out later.
Yeah.
He literally thought bats were, like, flying at him. And he just kept on screaming, I'm going to scratch your eyes out. I'm going to scratch your eyes out. He was literally trying to scratch my eyes out. So, you know, I was all bloodied up and he was bloodied up, but we finally got him in handcuffs and we got him, you know, medically cleared, and he went off to the mental health facility because, you know, he was in crisis. Yeah. And, but, you know, then I find out from his sister that he has hepatitis. And I've got open cuts, and he's got open cuts, so I had to go through all that bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, so, but at the same token, you know, it's like, I couldn't take it personally. You can't take that personally. You know, it's like, hey, this guy is in a crisis situation, and I'm here to help him. It's my job, and that's what we're going to do.
But that takes a pretty heavy amount of being able to compartmentalize. You know, a lot of things. I mean, for an average human being, going through a situation just like that one would be trauma.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but I mean, you're going through how many of these in your lifetime? And
right, a bunch.
How do you, right. So, I mean, are you able to just take it all and compartmentalize as this is what happened at work and this is my life? Or, I mean, do you have to find some way of being able to come to terms with some things?
Through the years, our department and most police departments are recognizing what you just said, that, you know what, these cops need some help.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I was talking to a good friend of mine that was seeing a therapist. He's an officer, and he told me, he said, you know what, the way this therapist explained it was, everybody's got a bucket.
Yeah.
And you just keep on putting bullshit in there after bullshit experience and blah, blah. Before you know it, that bucket's going to overflow. You know, you were seeing the dead baby. You're in the situation like what I just said, you know, or much worse. I've been involved in six different officer-involved shootings where an officer had to shoot and kill somebody. I was the incident commander for a police suicide. And it was somebody that I saw out drinking like 2 months before that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now I see him in his bedroom with his brain splattered all over this bedroom wall. You know, it does take a toll. There's no doubt about it. Like I said, humor is a big thing.
Right.
There is peer support groups. that are formal peer support groups. And finally, our department woke up and got a psychologist, a full-time psychologist that works for the department. And we have a coordinator that coordinates. It's a police officer, but he answers to the psychologist. He doesn't answer to anybody else.
Yeah.
So, finally, we're taking it a little more seriously. You know, we had a string of police suicides, and after that, we're all looking at each other. It's like, we got to do something.
Yeah.
You know, you can't keep ignoring what's going on here. Because before, it was like, suck it up, Buttercup.
Yeah.
You know, you're a wimp. Stop it. You know, like, boo-hoo. Yeah, and you're like, okay. And some people could do pretty good, and others can't.
Yeah.
And that's not a sign of weakness. It's just your personality. Right. Being a human being.
But that's a process to get people to recognize that.
Right. And unfortunately for us, it took a series of tragedies for them to recognize it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really good book. It's called Weekends at Bellevue. It was one of the first audiobooks I ever got. And I love audiobooks.
Yeah.
And this is a story of a gal who was in charge of the psych ward at Bellevue. And she would go in there Friday nights, and she wouldn't leave till Monday morning. She just worked weekends.
Yeah.
But it was like 24 hours, you know. And she was the head of the psych ward, and it was all these different stories. And eventually, she needed counseling.
Yeah.
She needed a shrink. And I don't say shrink, you know, in a derogatory manner.
No, it's just, I get it.
It's right. And I was, you know, I'm listening to the story, and I was thinking to myself, it's like, yeah, who takes care of the people who takes care of people?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, it made total sense to me. She's like, yeah, my bucket was full. It was overflowing. It's like, enough is enough, you know. So she needed some help, and she got it.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's good to hear that there's been a change in the dynamic over the years as far as, you know, because that is a thing. I mean, you do hear about cop suicides. You do hear about the toll that it takes on people, and the stigma surrounding people needing to get some help managing some of these stresses and things that they've been through. And it's great to hear that it's starting to change as far as, you know, the people being able to do that without being able to be looked down upon.
Yeah, in 2017, I looked this up before I got on the podcast here. In 2017, there were at least 103 firefighter suicides and 140 police officer suicides.
Yeah.
And that's in contrast, 129 officers died in the line of duty. So usually cops kill themselves more than we get killed on the street. And there's PTSD, depression, mental illness. It's a whole bunch of stuff, you know, abusing alcohol, abusing other drugs, you know, it's horrible.
Yeah.
You know, and you throw some, you know, you work midnight to 8, you work really long hours, then you miss out on all the family functions. Then your wife is looking, is like, hey, you missed, you know, little Johnny's birthday, you know, for the second year in a row. You know, you just were at a suicide where a guy blew his head off, and you're, you know, trying to find parts of his brain in the spokes of a tire.
Yeah.
You know, a couple hours before that, and you're trying to be normal.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, okay, sorry. Yeah. So why are you quiet? Why don't you want to talk to me? And it's like, all right.
Do I want to make this your trauma as well?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like I said, then, you know, then you pile on top of that all the internal pressures. You know, what cops dread more than anything else, it's not the danger of the job. I mean, we all understand we might get shot, we might get hurt. I mean, that's a part of the job. But what we really dislike is, hey, guess what? You just got a notification. You have to go up to internal affairs because of X, Y, or Z assignment.
Yeah.
Hey, you're getting investigated. Which means you could get suspended for X amount of days, or you could get fired.
Yeah.
And you don't know what the outcome of this for months. So you got that dark cloud just looming over your head. You know, and it's no fun. I've been threatened I don't know how many times up at IED.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just sucks. You're just like, oh, man, that's a huge stressor. And it's not because you're some rogue cop going crazy or whatever. You're doing your job, and people... if you do your job, you arrest a lot of people, you're in a very active part of the city, and say you're on an active squad, people are going to make complaints against you.
Yeah.
Because they don't like to see them, they don't like to see themselves going to jail, they don't like to see their kid going to jail, you know, or they get like half the story, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but that's a lot. And to be able to reach out and get some healthy coping mechanisms for all the things that you've got to go through is definitely a step in the right direction, because whether you are getting ideas from some books or a therapist or a wise friend with an ear, all of those things are pretty solid. But so is whiskey. So is those things are going to be there, and you're going to find a coping mechanism one way or the other. So if you're looking for something positive, you're more likely to have positive outcomes.
You're absolutely right. You know, the job itself is extremely stressful, and it's ebbs and flows. You know, it's like a roller coaster. But then you throw something such as a nasty divorce, a child with a horrible disease, you know, with a diagnosis of something, you know, like cancer or something like that, you know, on top of the bucket of shit that you have to deal with every day. Now it's really overflowing. Now you're really stressing out.
Yeah.
You know, that's when bad things happen. I personally went through a horrible divorce. It took over 2 years. You know, my marriage was, you know, over 20 years, and I had two kids.
Yeah.
And I was scared to death that, you know, I wanted to make sure that they were going to be okay. And my therapy was going to the gym. I'm a meathead. I mean, I just love going to the gym and throwing around weights and et cetera. But, you know, I did have a couple of pity parties here and there, and more than one time, you know, I drank way too much at these pity parties, but
yep.
I wasn't missing work. I wasn't affecting my job, and, you know, and I was able to recognize it's like, yeah, this is a pity party. This is not a lifestyle. I don't need to drink, you know, every day to kind of numb the pain.
Right.
You know, et cetera. And there's cops that I know that do that or have done that. And you'll crash and burn every time.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just talking to one of my cops that's going through a bad divorce now. And I always talk to him. I said, the last thing you want to do is crawl inside a whiskey bottle because you're going to drown.
Yeah. It's not sustainable.
No, the answer is not there. It feels okay for a little while.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable. I said, go to the gym. Go work out. You know, get away from the police shit as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's okay to have buddies that are cops and, hey, you know what, we're going to go work out and maybe we'll go out for a drink later. Don't make that a drink till 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. And don't make that a habit, okay?
Yeah.
Nothing good is going to come from that.
Yeah, keeping your head on straight is just generally good advice, but it's definitely good advice when you're going through a time when all you want to do is get away from the bullshit that you're in the middle of.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's sometimes people don't always listen to said advice. You know, you have to come to that realization yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me on all this. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I've just enjoyed the hell out of it.
Oh, cool! So have I. You know, this is really cool. It's and like you said before, it's good people are actually talking about it, and we're like two normal dudes just talking.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how people should see that. You know,
absolutely.
If they are having problems, you know, like I said before, police suicide is, you know, something near and dear to my heart. You know, I've lost a couple of friends through that. And like I said before, I was at the scene of one of them. And the fallout from that is just between the families and other coworkers. It's just the ripple effect is insane. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that people are actually like talking about it and trying to do something about it. And there's no shame in reaching out and trying to get a helping hand. There's a lot of hands out there trying that will help you.
Yeah.
And when somebody was in crisis, I said, you know what? There's always somebody out there that loves you. There's always. There's a friend. There's a parent. There's a brother. There's a sister. And sometimes it's your bartender. But, you know, we try to stay away from that. But, you know, there's somebody out there that does give a shit if you're here or not. There always will be. Always. You just have to remember that.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, you betcha.
See? Challenge your perceptions. Wasn't that a great time? That was an absolutely great time. If you want to make your art more realistic, especially the police procedural part of it, go to copsandwriters.com. That is where you're going to get all the insight, all the info on how to make it more believable. I'm talking to you, Harry Bosch. Get on down there and correct some stuff. Are you looking for some guests for your show? Are you thinking about starting a podcast, but you don't know where you're going to find guests? Go to podcastguests.com. It's the only place on the internet where you can find quality people looking to talk to you. They've been a supporter of this show when just about nobody else would. And it's been fantastic. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.